Welcome back to the program. It may be hard for young people to remember, but there was a time before 500 channels, before Hulu and iTunes and Apple TV, a time when three networks accounted for the sum total of what we watched and, more importantly, what shaped our popular culture. When Thursday night was must-see TV and totally dominated the conversation around water coolers and lunchrooms the next day. For a significant part of that era, the man in charge, the man responsible for that era of television, is our guest today, Warren Littlefield. He is the former NBC president of entertainment. He was an NBC comedy executive that developed such shows as The Cosby Show, Golden Girls, and The Fresh Prince of Bel-Air. It is my pleasure to welcome Warren Littlefield here to talk about his new oral history of that period, Top of the Rock, Inside the Rise and Fall of Must-See TV. Warren Littlefield, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Jeff. It's wonderful to be talking to you this morning.
Great to have you here. When one thinks about this era, it's important to sort of start at the beginning where NBC was back in the time you first went to work there, when of three networks it was often joked about, it was in fourth place.
Well, it's absolutely true. It was a renaissance for comedy at ABC, from Happy Days, Laverne and Shirley, Taxi, Barney Miller, outstanding comedy, CBS, All in the Family, Carol Burnett. They had outstanding shows. They had a dozen comedies. NBC had Different Strokes and Hello, Larry. And that's when I walked in there, and my feeling was, well, nowhere to go but up. And it took us a while. It really did. But the most important, I think, the deal, the auspices that changed the DNA at NBC was making a deal with the Charles Brothers and Jimmy Burrows. And they brought a sophisticated adult entertainment to NBC in Cheers. That was their creation. And as excited as we were about having that show, at the end of the first season, it was ranked at the absolute bottom in all of network television. There was no lower-rated show than Cheers.
And when you made that deal, it was essentially a blind deal. I mean, the show was pitched, as you say, as a Miller Lite commercial. But more importantly, the deal with the Charles was basically, whatever you want to do, we'll put you on, you know, the air for 13 shows.
NBC was desperate. and so when Bob Broder, who represented the Charles Brothers and Jimmy Burrows, when he shopped what NBC had put on the table to other networks, like, hey, I got this from NBC, the other guys went, well, we would never do that, because they weren't desperate. We were. But it, out of desperation came inspiration from them. I guess the smartest thing we ever did was, just because it was at the bottom of the heap, we didn't cancel it, because, in fact, we loved it. But it was a guy named Bill Cosby who came on to Thursday night and really turned all the lights on. And Bill, the moment he stepped on to Thursday night, he brought 35 million Americans with him. And once they were there, we could say, hey, while you're here, we've got this great show called Cheers. The next 10 years, Cheers is the pillar of Thursday night. So absolutely a case of patience rewarded and getting great people to come to work for you and letting them do exactly what they do.
I want to talk about that patience, because that's something that was in many ways indigenous to the time and very hard to imagine in the landscape of today.
I think that's absolutely true, Jeff. I think that patience is extremely difficult. And yet, for us, after Cheers, after a 10-year run of a remarkable celebrated series, what's the show that goes in and takes that mantle and actually surpasses it in performance? And that's Seinfeld. Seinfeld, some of the worst test results in the history of television. The test audience knew who Jerry Seinfeld was. They just didn't like the show. And it's actually the original test report I have signed by the entire cast and Larry David. It's framed, and it's right next to my desk at the office. And I look at that every day and smile. And it's a reminder that sometimes it's about going with your gut. It's not about what a research report will tell you. And a slow starter, you know, we put it on after Cheers in the summer. It was Cheers repeats. We threw them on, and Seinfeld did okay. Then it went up against Home Improvement. Home Improvement killed Seinfeld when they were matched up against each other on Wednesday nights. However, Jerry and Larry had wonderful, crazy brilliance in their heads, and we just couldn't let go. We knew we had something, and then ultimately when it moved to Thursday night, it took the mantle of Cheers and for the next decade carried Thursday.
I want to talk about test results because it's one of the things that got the network in the pickle that it was in when you got there. You had a guy there named Paul Klein who was very much into test results but had this idea of the least objectionable programming. Talk about that.
Well, LOP, least objectionable programming, was a strategy of, hey, don't piss off too many people. In a world where when Paul, and Paul, very bright guy, comes out of research, but in a world where the average household had five channel choices, then not pissing people off and just putting something comfortable on was a fine strategy. But as we entered the 90s and we looked at ourselves at NBC, we said, you know what, the average household now has about 50 channel choices. So who are we? Let's distinguish ourselves. Let's start refining the notion of who we are as a network, and we were ahead of our competition in that. And that's when our Thursday night, which had this kind of history from the 80s with Hill Street and Cheers as a night of bests, and, of course, Cosby, into how do we brand that? And that's where from the bowels of the promo department came must-see TV. And John Miller, who was running advertising and promotion, said, I like it, it rhymes. That was our entire test marketing. I like it, it rhymes. And the next day we had that on the air. And a brand is ultimately, it's a promise. It is a relationship that you have with the audience. And through the 90s, what we were able to do is create one network, one night for one decade, a brand that delivered for the audience. So at the height of must-see TV, we were getting 75 million Americans were making a commitment to be a part of the conversation, to be a part of that programming, or you just didn't want to show up for work the next day.
Part of it that evolved also was the demographic part of the branding, that NBC was becoming the young adult urban network. To what extent was that a conscious choice?
It really was a conscious choice. As we looked at the business side, what we realized is that the advertisers, Madison Avenue and Michigan Avenue, they were really rewarding us for not how many were watching, but who was watching, the quality of the audience. And so famously, we looked at a grid and Murder, She Wrote, that was a top 10 series on CBS, but absolutely a very older skewing show, versus St. Elsewhere, which was young and urban. And in terms of absolute numbers, St. Elsewhere was getting a fraction of what Murder, She Wrote was getting in terms of those absolute numbers. And yet, an advertising spot was bringing much more revenue in St. Elsewhere than what they were getting for Murder, She Wrote. And that was an eye-opener for me. And I said, well, you know, if we're going to distinguish ourselves, if we're going to try and identify who we are, let's aim there. Let's go to our history of Hill Street and a St. Elsewhere. And that should be a clue as to the kinds of dramas we do. Cheers should help inform us as to the kind of comedy that we do. As Bill Cosby stepped away, I didn't have a hit family comedy that I could follow the Cosby Show with. I let go of Roseanne. I didn't get it. Roseanne ended up on the competition. So my choice was, where do I go? I went for young adult comedy. I went for Mad About You, and Mad About You into Friends, and that into Seinfeld, and we had Frasier. And so that became very much the brand of who NBC would be in the 90s.
How hard was it to align everybody to those ideas? I mean, you had many bosses along the way. I mean, going all the way up to GE that owned the company.
Well, financially, it made a lot of sense. The question is, could we execute? And what we slowly were able to do is put pieces together, and the results were magnificent. So GE bought in because they saw it was working, and we beat the world. We were acknowledging, and this is absolutely in sync with GE strategy, see what the world is doing. See that the world is changing, and embrace that change. Don't be afraid of it. So it was a very heady time. I actually was in a strategic session with GE where they said, well, you know, that Thursday is more profitable than the other six nights of the week combined. And I said, yeah, it's a pretty amazing story, isn't it? And they looked at me and they said, you need more Thursdays.
One of the things about Seinfeld is that in addition to the program itself, it became cutting edge as it evolved in the structure of the show, and in many ways led television in a different direction.
Well, that's absolutely true. Jerry and Larry started with, of course, episodes like The Chinese Restaurant, where essentially everyone's just waiting to get a table at the Chinese restaurant, or The Parking Garage, where they can't find their car that they've parked in an enormous parking structure. And there wasn't a lot of story there. But then, almost accidentally, they found that when stories bumped into each other in surprising ways, that made them laugh. And then they became addicted to story. So for decades in the history of comedy, the structure had been two acts, mm-hmm. a total of seven scenes. Well, all of a sudden, Seinfeld was turning in scripts with 14, and then 20 scenes, and then 25 scenes. And the pace of comedy, the structure of comedy, shooting outside on the New York streets, going off on locations, then coming back and bringing shows onto their stage, they just changed the rules of how television comedy was made and kind of built it for a new generation, and it's never been the same since. They broke the mold. And I think if we did anything right, it's we allowed them to experiment and to stumble, and we allowed them to go. Quite honestly, we had no idea where they were going. We didn't know what they were up to. They were just following their instincts, and we let them.
What influence did Saturday Night Live have in shaping comedy at NBC?
Well, of course, Saturday Night Live brilliantly lives off of topical comedy. And the greatest years in the history of Saturday Night Live are election years, when they can absolutely mirror what is the dialogue of the American public. Who are the personalities, and put those up on screen and poke at them. And Saturday Night Live, the more relevant they are to the world around them, the better they do. And it's truly an amazing, amazing institution that they've stayed as vital today as they ever were.
One of the things about Saturday Night Live and about so much of this programming you've been talking about is that it was also a time of tremendous personalities, young actors that were coming up, many of whom were struggling before their shows were a success. Talk a little bit about some of those.
Well, it's unbelievable. For us, we had a strategy that television makes stars. And so you didn't know the cast of Cheers. You didn't know the cast of Seinfeld. You didn't know the cast of Friends. All these actors came into your home. And I think there's this wonderful, wonderful thing that happens when in your living room, wherever it is you view your television, you have this sense of I'm discovering someone. It ends up being a very close emotional bond where you feel like for the first time you've made a discovery. And that was something that we thought was an exciting and essential part of television, or the cast of Will and Grace. You put those actors in those roles, put them on, and then America latches on. And of course, so many of those actors have had huge careers, both on television, feature films, back in television. It was one of the reasons why, for me, Jeff, it was easy to get so many people to be interviewed for the book and talk about their experiences, because it was such an incredible success time for them in their lives. It was their time of discovery. You know, Matt LeBlanc said, do you have any idea, you know, what you did for my life? He said, I couldn't pay the rent. I was going to cash it in. It was over for me. And he said, you know, my life will never be what it was without that opportunity. And so, yes, he insisted on picking up the check for lunch when I interviewed him.
It also was, I mean, it sounds so simple, but it was a revolutionary idea at the time, because many of the other shows on other networks, CBS probably most specifically, were seen as star vehicles. And if there weren't stars in them, they didn't make it to the air.
Well, that's absolutely true. And I think it was just one of the ways we wanted to differentiate ourselves. As we branded our network as that younger, urban, hip, young adult network with must-see TV, we thought that's the way we wanted to go. That brand became, you know, really, really significant in the lives of the audience. We had a generation that grew up on must-see TV.
Was there concern early on about once you made the commitment to brand as being directed towards this hipper young adult urban network, that was also an audience and a demographic that could change on a dime, that was constantly changing in their own lives, and that you either had to stay ahead of them to some extent or it would be really easy to lose them?
Well, we weren't aiming for teens. Now, you want to talk about a fickle audience, it's a teenage audience. One of the fascinating things was when we put Friends on, and we were illuminating that time in 20-somethings' lives where they leave home, and they are in the big city, and they're in their first job, they're in their first relationship, their hopes and dreams on some days are coming to life, and on other days they're sputtering and dying. And that roller coaster ride of that time in someone's life, that was, of course, the essence of Friends, and of course, Ross and Rachel, and would they get together? So what was fascinating is as we got into the second season and we started to look at who's watching Friends, what we found is that nearly 25% of the audience was over 50, because the experiences that they were illuminating, which were wildly fun, but also deeply emotional, those were very universal experiences, and we were all young at one time. And so the way they wrote it, the way they delivered it, made it very, very relatable to a broad-based audience. So we owned kids and teens and young adults and all the way through the spectrum, and a good deal. Advertisers may not pay us a premium for them, but we also owned 50 plus as well. It was just a massive, broad-based hit, and that was good. That's what we wanted to do. We wanted to get the young adults, but we were doing things that were relatable enough so that it got everybody. You know, the CW as a network has a much tougher time because of their direct hit with teens, and you know, their core is like 12 to 34. That's a fickle audience. That's a tougher equation, but that really wasn't where we aimed.
How did you keep the balance with respect to the hour dramatic programming to keep up with what you were doing in comedy?
Well, the best thing we ever did was ER, and that scared a lot of people. No one had ever seen television that was quite as visceral as that. No one had ever seen as much blood. And the intention from Michael Crichton's original creation was to have doctors who were both real and heroes. And we thought in the evolution of dramatic television, we thought that if we made it feel that it was real, there would be a stronger connection to the dramatic material. Again, we took a lot of risks. Outstanding, powerful, exciting young adult cast, and it exploded. I mean, it was a time where, go figure, Jeff, does this sound familiar? Healthcare in America was a very hot topic. And here we were presenting a public hospital in Chicago where were these dedicated professionals could and would save lives. And that really resonated with the public. And then, you know, the Law and Order franchise also was a procedural that, strangely, audiences hadn't seen before. They knew doctor shows, they knew lawyer shows, they knew cop shows. This was crime and punishment, uniquely put together in an hour format. Test results, not good at all, but a unique proposal that seemed, as we looked at it, well, why not? That makes complete sense. And the more we put it out there, slowly, 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 the audience went, I get it. This is compelling. This works.
In many ways, ER did for drama what Seinfeld did for comedy in terms of reshaping structure and pacing and really making it a lot hipper.
Oh, without a doubt. And in pacing, you're absolutely right. They were shooting scripts. John Wells would call me and say, look, we keep upping the number of pages that we shoot. You know, we burn through material very quickly, and we're now shooting 65-page scripts. He said, but I'm calling you to tell you we're short, and I don't want to slow down the pace of the show. Can I deliver it short? And my answer was, now at this point, we're a 45 share. And my answer is, you know what, John? I'll figure out how to fill out that hour. I'll throw in another commercial or two. No one will be upset about that over here at the network, and you just keep doing the great job you're doing.
Talk a little bit about what you see in television today. You look at reality shows, the way TV has changed today, and how do you see it in the context of really the height of must-see TV?
Well, I think today the viewer is king. What's changed is we had one night that was a destination. It was a collective experience. And, of course, in a world of choice, that kind of changes. It really takes live event television to bring the tens of millions of people together the way we did each and every week on Thursday night. Now, live event television, we know gets the numbers in the Super Bowl, the Oscars, the NBA Finals. There are ways to accomplish that with one program on one network on a night. It just doesn't happen each and every week. So we all have, more and more every single day, DVR penetration goes up. And so whatever device you're looking at, when you want it, what you want is available to you. And so, like many viewers, I'm watching, I go on to my DVR, and I will see, I'll watch sports live, and that certainly is true for the larger public, but whether it's Game of Thrones, and then A Modern Family, and The Killing, all of this range of drama, Shameless, Homeland, all of these dramas, all of this great television, comedy, can't wait for another season of Curb Your Enthusiasm, they're all choices that are available to us, and they're collected and they're viewed when we want to watch them. So it changes the relationship that the viewer has with the TV. I think we still want to connect. Audiences want that communal experience. It's just a much smaller one. And as we know now, it can be instant. Blogging, social networking, literally when something is on. Now, not as many people are watching it live, but they're connecting. They want to share that experience. It's just in much smaller slices.
And the irony of it is that it takes it back to the conversations you had at NBC when you first got there, when there was this talk of big event television.
Yes. Yes, and there are so many program services out there that you can have the big live events, and those will bring many people, and those will carry it. It's why for NBC it's critical for them to have Sunday night football. That live event NFL programming in prime time drives eyeballs into their universe, and getting those mass eyeballs is more and more difficult than ever before. So you want a number of different choices. You want a brand. You want a brand to have consistency, but you also need explosions along the way that can pull lots of people in to hopefully sample your product.
Warren Littlefield, his book is Top of the Rock, Inside the Rise and Fall of Must-See TV. Warren, I thank you so much for spending time with us today.
Jeff, it's been my pleasure, and thank you.
Thank you.